Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
This episode is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. It's never an easy call with so many problems in the world to know where to direct the money that you donate when you want to help out in this world. But what I can tell you is that when you donate to CAMH, you're saving lives. We know about the opioid crisis. We know about the mental health crisis. They are doing the work. Help change mental health care forever. Your support will help CAMH build a future where no one is left behind. Donate at CAMH.ca/CanadaLand to help us treat addiction and build hope. Hey, I need you to pay close attention to this message. It is not an ad. This is about Canada Land, and this is about you. You need to know that the news crisis is about to get a lot worse. You've heard about the layoffs. We're about to have news closures, and it's very likely that we're going to be seeing the defunding of the CBC. Where are you going to get your information from? What can you do about this? You can support Canada Land. We need you to. And so for this month and this month only, you can become a Canada Land supporter and get everything our supporters get for just $2 a month. That is an almost 80% discount. The clock is ticking on this. It disappears at the end of the month, and then we will not offer it. We need your support. We need to keep news coverage alive in Canada. Go right now to canadaland.com/join. And thank you.
When I woke up this morning, it already felt like it was tomorrow.
Tomorrow is too late.
As we continue to build the University of Tomorrow,
walk our hallways, classrooms, and labs, and you can feel the hum of energy created by those discovering their purpose.
Today, we are excited to share with you our vision for our new brand.
At the University of Alberta, our local ideas translate into global impact.
We must transform our collective aspirations into reality today.
Every day, we set out to challenge the very notion of time by solving problems that don't exist yet.
Well, here's a problem that did exist last October when the University of Alberta released that inspiring video announcing their slick rebranding. They were in the midst of being defunded by the province of Alberta with nearly 20% of their provincial grants slashed since 2019. As a result, tuitions are up by as much as 104%, depending on which program you study. And the University of Alberta is not alone. Post-secondary schools across Alberta are being defunded to the tune of $460 million. And Alberta is not alone. Similar cuts have hit Ontario schools. British Columbia just announced a funding review for all post-secondary institutions. The bottom line is austerity, but the sales pitch is jobs. In April, the Alberta government released a document titled Alberta 2030, Building Skills for Jobs. And while large chunks of money were being taken from universities and colleges in general, smaller chunks of cash were provided to fund high-demand programs. Things like nursing, coding, and commerce. The impacts are both ideological and practical, raising questions about what the greater purpose of a university education should be and what specific programs a university or college needs to invest in if they want to keep the lights on. It's called performance-based funding, PBF for short. and it is already being used across the U.S. and in parts of Europe. The idea here is that governments shelling out to universities and colleges should be getting ROI, return on investment. So what does that look like for students? Edmonton-based reporter Omar Salafu has that in a moment. Wait for it. This episode is brought to you by Matt Jarvis, Blaine Anderson, Robin Ull, Nicole Brandsma, Robin Batchelor, Joshua Lee, Christy Greer, and Aaron.
My name is Aaron. I'm a writer and filmmaker in Toronto, and I support Candleland because the Canadian media gets away with a lot of bullshit, and we need people like Jesse and his team to keep them in check.
Anita Cardinal is an Indigenous law student at the University of Alberta with a unique academic journey.
Okay, so I am an older student, so I'm 45, I have three sons, I have a grandson, and always in the back of my mind, I've always wanted a career in law. It was something that I think I forgot about as I got older. When I was quite young, I just had an acquaintance of mine who knew me in junior high, saw me on Instagram and sent me a really sweet message. And she said, "I don't know if you remember me, but I see that you're in law and I thought that you would really appreciate this." And she sent me a screenshot of our yearbook back in junior high. And, you know, sadly, I was never able to buy that yearbook, so I never got to see it because we couldn't afford it, right? So they had my picture, of course, and then it's like, "What's your goals?" And I said I wanted to be an actress or a lawyer. Right? So I was just so blown away when I saw that because it reminded me of that hope that I had back then. And sadly enough, as you get older and you start realizing all those barriers, that hope went away. And then I think it was always there, but it was like became almost impossible, like an impossible dream.
With support from her family and previous community college education, Anita worked towards her dream legal career by obtaining a paralegal diploma from Grant MacEwan University in 2010. Her paralegal work spanned a decade and included legal files that Anita sometimes had a personal connection to.
I got to work on the CC Scoop file, the forced sterilization of Indigenous women here in Alberta. My mother is a representative plaintiff, and that was something that I had advocated for because, for obvious reasons. And all those things started to really, you know, bring that hope back again that I could. And then meeting Indigenous lawyers, because I had not met Indigenous lawyers, definitely not growing up. Not until I think it was in my 30s that I met an Indigenous lawyer, you know? And so I just got inspired by the people around me. And I started to have that confidence that I could do this. But there were still so many barriers, right? There were still so many things and mountains that I had to climb in order to see that this reality, right? Yeah. To make it my reality. And yes, absolutely. Financially, that's a, especially being, you know, my age and having a family. We had mortgage, we had vehicle payments. I applied to law school, and I only applied to the University of Alberta because I couldn't afford to go anywhere. So I literally, all my eggs were in one basket. We couldn't afford to move. It was not possible. So it was like U of A, that was my one chance. So if I didn't get accepted, I would not be in law school right now.
Thankfully, in 2019, Anita's dream became a reality when she was accepted into the University of Alberta. When I spoke with Anita, she was just wrapping up exams for the spring. But what was an affordable education for Anita in 2019 might not be for the next person looking to pursue this dream. Next fall, tuition at the University of Alberta is rising by nearly 30% for new students, a difference of more than $3,000 annually. Alberta is at the forefront of several provinces radically changing how they fund post-secondary education, with deep budget cuts across many universities and colleges. Universities across Alberta have lost $460 million in their annual provincial funding grants since the UCP formed government in 2019. And the largest university in the province, the University of Alberta, lost $200 million of base funding over 3 years and has undergone radical academic restructuring from a multiple faculty model into a smaller college model, introduced mass staff layoffs, and year-over-year tuition increases. Students across the province are now burdened with filling the hole left behind by provincial funding cuts. This year alone, students are projected to pay $150 million more in tuition, according to the Alberta Union of Public Employees.
So in the end, we're faced with three choices, faced with incurring a debt that you would be stuck paying for too long. And for those who with families like myself or future families will essentially put them under a financial strain that will last for years. Or on the other hand, not even being able to attend law school or go elsewhere for those who can. And the majority will go elsewhere.
The university tried to calm opposition to tuition increases by pointing students to increased bursaries, scholarships, and loan options. But that really didn't stop the backlash. The $3,000 increase law students are facing this fall is actually an improvement. The tuition hike that was originally proposed was supposed to be 45%, or about $5,000 more per year. But after a group of students, including Anita, spoke out about the increase, it was lowered.
So banking on potential bursaries that most students are not even aware of before they apply to law school is not feasible. It makes no sense. So yes, there is now more bursaries that are being created, and it's not going to be all merit-based, but it's still, you can't rely on those. You don't know how much you're going to get, when you're going to get it, how that's going to help you.
Students, however, are not the only ones paying for these cuts.
So I'm going to ask a lot of you when we read that text. I'm going to push you to think about...
On the other side of the river in Edmonton, students at Concordia are also in their final days of their semester.
Canadians' colonial policies that have for years...
Reginald Weeb is who you're hearing right now as he teaches English 384, Contemporary Canadian Literature at Concordia University. In an academic market that's clouded by budget cuts, Reg sometimes views his opportunity to teach English as a miracle, really.
It felt to me when this job came open and it was in my field and in my city, it felt like winning the lottery. The academic job market is incredibly competitive. It varies from discipline to discipline. In English, there are more grads than there are jobs. And so this has resulted in a lot of institutions relying heavily on sessional labor. They have a workforce available that they can underpay. And I feel very grateful to have a job. I feel supported by my colleagues very much. But I think the system in which we rely predominantly on sessionals to do a lot of the teaching is a sort of a fundamentally unjust system.
The use of sessional instructors, stagnant salaries, and workload were all issues raised by the Faculty Association at Concordia in their last round of collective bargaining with the university. After negotiations stalled and asks were consistently unmet by the university, the faculty at Concordia called a formal strike, making history as the first ever faculty strike in Alberta. The faculty took to the picket line earlier this year on January 4th, with the cruel luck of coinciding with a cold snap in Edmonton that dropped temperatures to a bone-chilling minus 40.
In my context, I teach English courses, so we're capped at 30 students, but that means 120 students a semester. So that's, you know, 120 students submitting essays twice a year, so hundreds of essays. And it also means about 3 hours of course prep per 1 hour of teaching. So that's about 3 hours of prep and 1 hour of teaching for every class.
The consequences of heavy workloads on professors was studied in 2019 by a University of Manitoba researcher. In her interview-based research, the study found that the four major factors that contributed to workload creep were, quote, a changing academic climate from collegial academic leadership to governance and control, accountability and audit processes, surveillance and control, and resulting never-ending tasks.
So if I'm teaching four classes, that's 4 hours of teaching a week, plus 3 hours per class, which puts me doing approximately 40 hours a week of work just at the teaching level. That's before grading. That's before doing any service. We serve on committees and we assist students informally. We help our colleagues informally in addition to formal service commitments. And so then that means that our research load almost fell entirely into the summers, which are often described as periods of recuperation. And a system where you require recuperation from your job is not a system that's really built sustainably. Despite the fact that we would continue to offer new, less ambitious salary proposals, we kept lowering our salary requests. There was no movement, and so a strike was unfortunately inevitable. We were on strike for 10 days. The first week was in sub minus 30 temperatures. We were picketing in very frigid weather, but the strike was an incredibly powerful moment for us as a faculty association and as a community. One of the things we discovered was that our individual pain and stress was shared. With the 4-4 teaching load, getting through the work week is a challenge. Managing our workloads, meeting our students' needs, meeting our own needs becomes very difficult. And then so we don't have time to realize how the rest of our colleagues are feeling. We discovered that we were all feeling the same things, and we found unity and purpose together. It was inspiring.
The historic strike at Concordia was successful. So that means that professors will now have a reduced workload and a small salary increase.
The gains made in the collective agreement were small steps towards ameliorating our pay scale compared to our colleagues in other institutions in the province and across the country. One of the things about picketing in minus 40 with the wind chill is that you must be resolved. If you're not serious, if you do not believe what you're doing, then you would not be torturing yourself this way. And I sincerely believe that our administration has Concordia's best interests at heart, but we had a fundamental disconnect on how those would be best served, how our students would be best served. And we believed strongly enough that we went outside in minus 40 to show our students and their community members how much we value the institution and how important it was to fight for it.
But again, the budget cuts didn't stop at students, and it didn't stop at professors at institutions across the province. Administrative staff work to support students and create academic environments for the benefit of students and professors. And admin are often the lowest paid workers on campus. So when cuts come down from administration, support staff are often the first to go. Since 2019, the University of Alberta has cut 2,000 administrative jobs and privatized cleaning staff contracts. The University of Calgary has also targeted its caretaker workers by removing a $2.50 night shift premium. The premium was in place to acknowledge the often financial hardship involved with shift work that can span from 10 p.m. to 6 a.m.
I worked it out that $2.50 premium that we got for the evening and night shifts equaled roughly $4,875.
Dave Lamont is a caretaker at the University of Calgary who works in facility maintenance.
$4,875 coming off of my yearly pay. That's a really big deal for somebody who's already sitting at the bottom. You know, I have my house, I have roommates, I have to increase their rent because I can't cover my whole responsibility with the house anymore. You know, gas is going up like crazy, insurance is going up like crazy, groceries. Inflation is just out of control, and it just feels like this is the worst time to cut the people at the bottom. I understand that it's not going to work well for everybody, but the people at the bottom are the ones who are going to suffer. You can cut the middle and they might lose aspects of their lifestyle, but you could literally end up with people having to choose between heating your house and eating. So for me, the money was a big deal. And to be honest, I'm having to consider looking for another job at this point because that $2.50 made all the difference.
The pandemic really wasn't a break for caretakers. They spent the better part of 2 years on the front line with backpack sprayers, hazmat suits, and all of this without any hazard pay. Caretakers at U of C rallied this spring against budget cuts and the removal of their shift differential. At the rally, signs read, quote, "We took care of you. Why didn't you care about us?" Dave was at the rally, and his experience meeting with workers was surprisingly similar to the newfound solidarity Reg felt at Concordia's strike.
I did attend the rally. My shift at that time was from 4 p.m. until midnight. I decided to show up at noon, and I spent the whole 4 hours walking in front of the administration building and chanting and wearing the sign that had various facts on it. I think it did what it needed to do. It brought our issue to a more visible group and just let them know that there is a problem. Like, and you know, we're not going to sit there and be quiet and just take it. We want people to know that we're going to get out there and speak our mind and stuff like that. And it gives voice to the people who weren't able to show up as well. Because again, a lot of these people have lifestyles that just don't mix with showing up for that sort of a rally. They have two jobs or three jobs or children or, you know, a parent at home to take care of or what have you. So yeah, I thought the rally was great and I had a great time.
Ultimately, these ripple effects felt throughout post-secondary institutions are a part of a systemic change the United Conservative Party in Alberta is pursuing in how higher education is funded. They've made cuts to general operating budgets while funding certain projects at particular schools. For example, a $23 million investment in a quantum physics hub headquartered at the University of Calgary, or $85 million in funding targeted only at certain programs, including nursing, engineering, and aviation. This is all part of a departure from how post-secondary funding has normally been handled, which is to say that general funding was provided based on enrollment numbers, and it was largely left to schools to figure out how they would spend that money. Additionally, the UCP have begun implementing something called performance-based funding, which pegs university funding to metrics like course completion, graduation rates, and graduate salaries. It's also being implemented in other provinces, but it was originally pioneered in the US, first in Tennessee and Ohio, but the practice is becoming more widely recognized internationally, including in the United Kingdom. The effectiveness of metrics funding has not really been well researched, but the information that we do have shows largely negative outcomes for universities that are now faced with lower funding and bloated administrative costs to manage performance tracking. And it's not just student funding that's being tied to these new metrics. In the UK, for example, research funding, more than $1 billion worth, is tied to a performance-based model. The Research Excellence Framework, or REF, assesses research quality and measures it on a 1-4 scale, with 4 meaning that a university has world-class research that is original, significant, and rigorous. This framework has been criticized, though, for its bloated administrative costs and for how the system defines a researcher's impact. It's been found to narrow the kind of research done for the sake of funding. The governments of Alberta and Ontario have both already pushed to introduce performance-based funding metrics, tying as much as 60% of a school's total operating funds to these programs in Ontario. But the pandemic did cause the provincial governments to pause and temporarily scale back this funding model's implementation. But it has only been a pause, not a course change. As an English professor at the University of Manitoba, Brenda Austin-Smith has seen government policy transform education in her 30 years of experience as an academic union activist. She pointed out that universities are already subjected to extensive fiscal accountability through financial reports, government audits, and regulations on school spending.
So we already have accountability measures. So these kinds of performance-based funding ideas coming from provincial governments kind of present themselves as if there's nothing going on in terms of accountability at universities, which isn't true. And the second thing they do is they come up with measures that we have no control over. So we can't affect them. Two of the biggest are the performance is supposed to be based on the number of students who successfully graduated I can't control that. And how much money they made after they graduated. I can't control that either. So it sets impossible targets, which sets you up for inevitable failure, and then conceivably punishes you for not being able to meet targets that are outside your power to meet. So that's what I mean when I call it disingenuous.
Our post-secondary education system today has a diversity of options and institutions. And while access is still limited by cost and other barriers, students across Canada can still benefit from schools that are heavily backed by government funds. This wasn't really always the case, and Brenda really worries that we might slide back to an educational past that's marked by exclusivity.
A little over 100 years ago, in the early part of the 20th century, before the First World War, the idea of going to university was available only to the very rich, and certainly the very white, and the very well-connected, and to men. Like, not a lot of women went to university. And you went to university because your parents or your family could afford it. And what we saw coming out of, particularly after the Second World War, was an opening up of public institutions and a recognition that education was becoming more of a right, that you can't participate fully in civic life and in society without an education. You deserve an education, and it should be cheap, ideally free. And then what we saw in the 1970s in Canada and elsewhere was what we called massification, which was really the setup of colleges and universities from coast to coast, in big cities and small towns, in order to provide that access. So you didn't have to take a plane to Toronto and rent an apartment in order to get an undergraduate degree. You could walk down the hill. That's amazing. And that was accessibility. And what we're seeing in the last few years, particularly since the rollout of the Truth and Reconciliation report, right, of the commission, is a call for more openness, more accessibility, particularly to Indigenous learners. Those calls for opening up the system, making it more accessible, making it cheaper, is happening at the very same moment that provincial governments in particular are stripping money from the system, making it more and more private. And if we make it private, we're going back 100 years.
Representatives from the provincial government have stated that the intent of this change in funding is done so that post-secondary education aligns with the job market. It's why they've made recent investments in chosen programs like aviation and finance technology that align with rising market interests and increases the number of seats available to students. For Brenda, though, this is a concerning approach to education.
So my concern is narrowing, telling people what they can't study, telling students what they can't know. And my other example, I guess, is who knew that in the last 5 years, we would suddenly think, time to pick up a couple of books on what led to the Second World War, given what's going on with Russia and Ukraine. Who would have thought that? So can you imagine a provincial government that made a decision and said, you know what, I don't think we need Eastern European history anymore, and stopped funding it? Where would we be now? So we can't know as a society. We don't know what we're going to need to know in the future. That's why we teach history, because nobody knows what they're going to need 25 or 50 years from now. But you educate and share because it's part of our shared history. So that's my concern. We lose access to knowledge.
For students not studying in market-relevant programs, these funding changes will mean tuition increases and likely a decline in the quality of education they receive. For example, this spring, the University of Alberta announced its plan to close its entire humanities building for, quote, space optimization. Now more than ever in Alberta, the quality of your education seems like it will be dictated by the job market instead of curiosity or a thirst for knowledge. For Anita Cardinal, the next step of her law career is entering a future that might not be possible for students after her.
Well, it starts with admissions, right? It starts, so where you decide to go to law school, why you decide to go there, and is it a welcoming space? Is it a space that's going to help you succeed rather than create more barriers for you now and in the future? And U of A has the potential to be able to do that. And, you know, I am an advocate for U of A. I had a great 3 years here. So I want to see them do the very best to make sure that people from all backgrounds can succeed here.
Coming up, my interview with Alberta's Minister of Higher Education. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's amazing the things that we tell ourselves to talk ourselves out of getting help. Anybody who's actually gotten help knows that the process of getting things off your chest, of taking your stressors, your problems, and just like not letting them be bottled up, working through just conveying them to somebody, half of the battle is just doing that. You unburden yourself. And you know what? If you have a real mental health professional, no, they don't have magic bullets or magic words that make it all go away. But often they can help you see things a little bit differently and guide you to strategies or tools or to a new perspective that actually does help. As the largest online therapy provider in the world, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. Because you listen to this podcast, you get 10% off of your first month at betterhelp.com/CanadaLand. That's betterhelp.com/CanadaLand. This episode is brought to you by Douglas, a mattress trusted by more than 200,000 Canadians from coast to coast to coast. Trust is important. There are a lot of mattress lies out there, a lot of mattress liars. And I didn't intend the pun, but it occurred to me that there is one as I was saying those words. Listen, I am not lying to you. I have experienced the Douglas mattress. It is an exceptional mattress at a surprisingly affordable price point. It is a mattress that sleeps cool, doesn't have that weird thing in the summer where the mattress gets like an oven. It's a very good product. It's delivered to your house in a box. You don't have to go to a big mattress store. It is a medium firm mattress, which is what Canadians prefer, and it comes with a 365-night trial and a 20-year warranty. What more can I tell you? Douglas is giving our listeners a free sleep bundle with each mattress purchase. Get the sheets, pillows, mattress, and pillow protectors free with your Douglas purchase today. Visit douglas.ca/CanadaLand to claim this offer. Maybe you could start by just introducing yourself and letting our listeners know what you do.
Yeah, absolutely. So my name is Dimitri Nikolaides, and I'm the MLA for Calgary Bow and Minister of Advanced Education.
I'm looking at the changes that university students are facing in Alberta, and some of this looks really drastic. They're facing tuition hikes. Some of these are really alarming, like a 104.5% increase for graduate psychology students, undergrad students facing as much as 44% tuition increase. Where are students supposed to come up with this money? How are they supposed to deal with this?
First and foremost, all students currently in those programs are grandfathered in. So it cannot apply to students that are currently in the program, only to new students who are starting that program. As well, once the increases have been completed, in the vast majority of circumstances, those programs still, from a cost perspective, remain below or near the national average. It's also important that we do take additional steps to bolster student aid and student financial assistance. So one of the things that I looked at specifically was to see whether the institution was planning on using some proceeds of the new revenue to support student assistance and student financial assistance more specifically. And they all were. And as well, the government of Alberta is also increasing what we're providing in student financial assistance. We're providing $12 million over 3 years to support our existing scholarships and $15 million over 3 years to create a new bursary for low-income students. Because I think we can all agree that financial barriers should not limit somebody's ability and potential to be able to access post-secondary education.
It shouldn't be a barrier, but in some cases it is. We spoke to an Indigenous law student. New law students are facing an increase of 29% this fall. The student we spoke with is really concerned, specifically about the impact of these hikes on diverse students who have gone through quite a bit to get to the point where they're accepted and ready to embark on things like law school. Are the increases in student aid or scholarships enough to cover the changes that students like that are now facing?
We do survey and talk with students regularly. We just completed a survey very recently whether students are able to meet their financial obligations with what student aid offers. The vast majority of students have indicated that they are able, and what is being offered through student aid is sufficient to help students. But of course, we need to continue to look at that.
Taking a bird's eye view at this, I don't want to give people a false impression. I think it's all well and good to point to improvements in the programs and to some of these measures like student aid. But we're not just talking about a one-year thing here. Like, my understanding is that these cuts have been happening year over year. A CBC investigation found last summer that over the two prior years, the University of Alberta had its provincial base operating funding slashed by 19%, University of Calgary 12%. Like, how long can this sustain? It's one thing to say financial barriers shouldn't get in the way, but these cuts are increasing financial barriers, and they're happening year over year. Are you done yet, or are more cuts coming?
As a government, we set out with an ambitious goal and target to balance the budget. We naturally had to take a very close look at funding that was provided to post-secondary institutions. And what we saw was that post-secondary institutions in Alberta were receiving disproportionately higher funding amounts from the provincial government than was the case in other provinces. So we had to make some corrections. We're seeing new investment. We are starting to reinvest into the post-secondary system. In fact, have recently rolled out $171 million over 3 years to create 10,000 additional spaces in our post-secondary institutions. So I think we've made some of the difficult decisions, made some of the corrections, and we're now in a position where we can start to expand capacity and make sure that everybody has an opportunity to attend post-secondary.
Well, not everybody. I mean, that $171 million is very targeted. Certain programs are receiving extra help while the rest are getting cut. So energy, healthcare, aviation, finance, finance technology, computer science, information technology. It seems like this isn't just belt tightening. There's a philosophical shift in how the province wants to spend money on post-secondary. It seems like you're targeted towards like vocational training. Is that a fair characterization?
No, I wouldn't say so. And I've heard that characterization. And just for clarity, so the government of Alberta does not fund specific programs. Funding is provided to post-secondary institution as a block operating grant. We don't provide any details as to how the institutions should use those operating dollars, except that they're to be used for operations. Over the past few years, we've made some reductions to the operating grant that we've provided to institutions. With the $171 million, what we are seeing and the intent behind this, there are many programs where there are very high wait lists. There's incredible demand. Like, I'll give you an example, like in veterinary medicine, we hear a lot of concern that there are not enough vets in the province and that we need more vets. Yet at the same time, the program is very limited in their capacity. They receive more applications at the University of Calgary than they're able to accommodate due to capacity. So you start to scratch your head and wonder, we have more students who want to go into this program and there's demand from the labor market, but we're not able to meet that demand because of capacity limitations. So I don't agree with the premise that, you know, we're trying to prioritize some programs.
I'm not sure you're actually disagreeing, because if it's not just about the wait list, but if it's about the probability of getting a job, of what the market demands, that is a philosophical shift from, you know, education for its own sake. I'm aware your government has announced that you're investing $23 million in a quantum physics hub. I'm not aware of any similar investment in anything in the humanities. Before even criticizing that, I think we just need to recognize that there is a shift in thinking about what education is for and why the province would pay for it and what it wants to prioritize. It does seem like vocation is on your list of criteria for directing these funds.
Well, the broad view and the lens that, you know, through which I view post-secondary education, and that I think students view post-secondary education as well, is from a career-oriented standpoint. I think it's important that we have job-ready graduates. And when our students finish whatever program they're in, they'll need to begin their career in whatever occupation that is. And so I think there is a focus indeed, and that focus is on ensuring we have job-ready graduates, including in the arts. I'm an arts graduate myself. I provide a lot of very valuable skills that are needed in the economy in terms of communication and critical thinking and other skills. So indeed, I think it's very important for us to look at post-secondary education through the lens of jobs and job-ready graduates. It's important to our economy, but more importantly, it's critical to our students.
Maybe we could even expand our focus beyond just what your government is doing with these specific cuts. You and I both, having done humanities programs for our undergrad, maybe benefited from a prior conception of what university is for, where you could kind of just fuck around for a few years and you'd not know what you're going to do. Even if you are there with the hope of getting like a good job afterwards, for many, many decades, we sort of made people go through learning philosophy, history, literature. Maybe this is incredibly outdated, but I feel like I benefited from not going to, 4 years of journalism school right out of high school. And I prefer politicians who, like yourself, have not just been doing politics since, student government, and journalists who have specific knowledge about other topics before they focus on vocational training. That was the tradition for many, many years. It seems like your government is not alone. There are conservative governments across North America who are really shifting post-secondary education to a job-focused outcome and making funding contingent on that. Is that not losing something really valuable?
Yeah, I certainly agree. There's an incredible part of the post-secondary experience is being able to dip your toe into a variety of different subjects and topics. And that still remains the case. I remember during my time at the University of Calgary, I graduated with a Bachelor of Arts in History and International Relations. But in order to convocate, in order to finalize my program, the requirement of the university was that I had completed certain courses or certain level of credit in science in other areas that weren't necessarily related to political science, history, or international relations. But the focus on labor market outcomes, for lack of a better term.
There is a hue and cry, maybe to be expected, from universities in Alberta, but this is common among, from the academy everywhere, that when you tie funding to outcomes, when you introduce performance-based funding metrics, you're fundamentally changing the relationship, the independence of the academy, and policy dictates outcomes. That's going to change what's invested in, how the whole thing runs. Are you worried about that?
So we are making some changes to how funding is provided to post-secondary institutions. As I mentioned before, government used to just provide a block grant, an operating grant, and say, here's your operating grant and use it as you need to finance your operations. And we're changing that to a performance-based funding model, whereby the government will provide the institutions with their operating grant and establish targets against key metrics in discussion. This isn't a punitive action, in discussion with post-secondary institutions to have clarity on what the return is for that investment.
That's a little cold and, it sounds like a very transactional way of thinking about education, return on investment in some kind of immediately measurable kind of model.
Well, it's a very important investment. I mean, it's $2 billion in the government of Alberta. It's $2 billion that the government provides to our post-secondary institutions. And there's no question it's an incredible and worthwhile investment. But I think it's a much deeper issue of how accountability is structured in the post-secondary system and how governance is structured. And I'm not sure that we have the best approach. So for example, funding is provided from an operating standpoint, and then the government of Alberta appoints the board chair, appoints the majority of board members, provides a mandate to the institution, and essentially, provides them direction and expectations through the board governance. But I'm not so convinced that's the best model. I prefer a model where we actually relax some of those controls. We don't get involved in appointing the board members, the board chair, other levels of that detail, but we simply provide funding and we set very clear high-level expectations and outcomes through a performance-based model and let them do their thing, let them employ their expertise and achieve those outcomes.
Let me climb out of my ivory tower and off my soapbox and approach this a bit more pragmatically. Alberta has been shedding young people. There are two separate studies that have found that more young people are leaving Alberta than moving into the province for the first time since the late 80s. You've brought up many times in this conversation that Alberta has been offering tuitions at much lower than the average, than the national average. But as a means of attracting people to the province, aren't you working against that interest?
No, I don't believe so. There's multiple pieces. And when we talk about retaining and keeping young people, there's no question that we have to do that. And we have to keep the best and brightest here. I think there's multiple pieces to that. Yes, there's attraction. How do you encourage young individuals to leave other provinces and say, I want to go study at the University of Alberta, or I want to go to Calgary? I think a lot of that has to do with reputation and ranking and quality. What we do know experts in my department have told me is that, you know, students will move to other provinces, to other jurisdictions, pay higher tuition, and make all those changes if they truly believe they're getting a higher quality experience.
I mean, you're right. There are some students who will pay more if they believe they're getting higher quality. And those are students who can afford to pay more. So I think one question here is, which kind of students are you trying to attract and retain?
I don't believe that we're focusing on any particular kind of student. Again, you know, for me, when we talk about tuition levels, it's very important that our tuition levels are competitive. We have very competitive tuition rates. Yet I think there's great opportunity for so many young people to look at coming to Alberta and studying here, getting a high quality education at comparable rates in an incredible province, and then having great prospects and outcomes at the end of it. And I think Alberta provides them with those opportunities.
Minister, I really appreciate you taking so much time to talk with me today.
Of course. Yeah, really enjoyed it. Thank you very much for having me.
That's your Canada Land. If you like this show, please support us. It's so easy. Click on the link in the show notes or go to canadaland.com/join. We rely on your support. You can email me. I'm at jesse@canadaland.com. I read everything you send. We're on Twitter @CanadaLand. Our website is canadaland.com. Catch a new episode of The Backbench this week. Parliament is wrapping up this summer and ramming shit through. Find out what's going on in Ottawa by listening to The Backbench. This episode was reported by Omar Salafu. Tristan Capicchione is our audio editor and technical producer. Our senior producer is Sarah Larniuk. Kieran Oudshorn is our managing editor. I'm your host, Jesse Brown. Our theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is handled by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. You can visit them online at cfuv.ca. Once again, if you like the show or anything that we do at this network, please support us by going to canadaland.com/join or click on the link in the show notes and have a look at all the stuff we want to give you as a token of our appreciation for your support. Hey, I need you to pay close attention to this message. It is not an ad. This is about Canada Land, and this is about you. You need to know that the news crisis is about to get a lot worse. You've heard about the layoffs. We're about to have news closures, and it's very likely that we're going to be seeing the defunding of the CBC. Where are you going to get your information from? What can you do about this? You can support Canada Land. We need you to. And so for this month and this month only, you can become a Canada Land supporter and get everything our supporters get for just $2 a month. That is an almost 80% discount. The clock is ticking on this. It disappears at the end of the month, and then we will not offer it. We need your support. We need to keep news coverage alive in Canada. Go right now to canadaland.com/join. And thank you.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.